For a bit of a devotional scene, I direct your attention to Luke chapter 14. Luke 14, we're going to begin reading at verse 16. I don't have the benefit of knowing what all you heard and experienced, learned this morning, but some years ago when All Nations was at Upton, we went and learned to know some of what they do and got on their mailing list and have been following them some since and have been encouraged and challenged by what we learned. And when we learned that you were having them here today, we decided if we could, we would come at least for a part of it. So we're glad to be here to learn more and to be encouraged together in God's work. Luke 14, beginning at verse 16. Then he said unto them, a certain man made a great supper and bade many. And he sent his servant at supper time to say unto them that were bidden, come, for all things are now ready. And they all with one consent began to make excuse. And the first said unto him, I have bought a piece of ground, and I must needs go see it. I pray thee, have me excused. Another one said, I have bought 5 yoke of oxen, and I go to prove them, and I pray unto thee, have me excused. And another said, I have married a wife, and therefore I cannot come. So that servant came and shewed his lord these things. Then the master of that house was angry, and said unto his servant, go out quickly into the streets and lanes of the city, and bring in hither the poor and the maimed and the halt and the blind. And the servant said, Lord, it is done, and as thou hast commanded, and yet there is room. And the Lord said unto the servant, go out into the highways and the hedges and compel them to come in, that my house may be filled. For I say unto you that none of those men which were bidden shall taste of my supper. When I was asked to share some scripture and some thoughts, my mind went around a little bit, and I thought of this, and what comes to my mind here is that the going out into hedges and highways and compelling them to come in indicates some effort. Something that wasn't easy, something that took work, and a little bit more. And we live in a society which, by and large, is content not to come in. However, perhaps we're not as diligent as we could be about inviting them. There might be more around that are looking for a place to eat than we really know. And there are some, as we sang a little while ago about the footsteps of Jesus, we've heard him calling. There are a lot of people that All Nations reaches out to that have never heard him calling, at least not clearly. And when they have the scriptures, they will have that call. So let's pray that God will lead us and inspire us this evening and in the days ahead, as we kneel together and pray.
Good evening, everyone. It's a blessing to be back here with you all again. Thank you for the good day, for the time this morning, time of fellowship, for the meal at lunch, and we really felt welcomed and are thankful that we had the opportunity to be here with you today. Okay, so as I said this morning, We looked at, in our Sunday school hour, we looked at kind of the vision and mission and maybe some of the kind of nuts and bolts then of All Nations and how we solve the problem of reaching the unreached. Can anyone tell me, how do we solve the problem? How do we achieve our vision, which is this, communities of believers in every language group living out the Word of God? How do we solve that problem when there's approximately 2,000 languages have owned the Bible of the unreached? Millions of people. What is the solution? I suggested a solution. Proposed a solution. Who will reach these Bibleless groups? Who is responsible to reach these Bibleless groups? Me? Yeah, absolutely. Any volunteers? Specialized organizations like ABT? Remember our mission statement? We partner with who? With churches. We partner with churches. And I had this little quote that I like saying, churches like yours sending people like you. So one of the purposes that I'm here today is to talk about the needs in the world, to look at the different projects, to talk about, and then also how we can all participate. And one of those ways of participating in this need is, one of those ways is by going. And there is many people today, I shouldn't say many, but there's folks, single brothers, single sisters, couples, and churches that are saying, let's do this. And so one of my prayers is that, who knows, maybe it's an 8-year-old child that's sitting here today. Who knows, maybe it's a 35-year-old single. Who knows? Maybe God will call someone from this congregation to join into this work. So that's my prayer. And all of us can be participating in many, many ways. And I want to talk a little bit about here in the beginning, something that I care a lot about and something that's really important for anybody going to the farm field, a characteristics of a missionary, but also for us right here in this county, right here in this town, for us in State College. And I wasn't quite sure if I was going to go here this evening. I wish I was more prepared. But our brother touched on this here when he read out of Luke 14. And there's a couple parables here that Jesus gives, and they're all around meals. And one of the parables before that, he's saying, if you just invite your friends into your house for a meal, that's not really that neat or that good, because guess what? Your family, your friends, your church people invite you back. But rather, you need to be inviting the poor, the maimed, the lame, the blind. And then he goes into that parable, that great supper of going out and bringing in. So I want to tell you a little bit of a story that ties into a project that we're just getting started right now in Iraq. So first of all, we're going to tell a story, And then we're going to kind of get into a little bit about this project. But before I do that, I don't want to forget this. Could, and we're thinking about Bibleless groups, could I have a volunteer to come up here and find 1 Timothy 2, 4 in the Bible of the Unreached? I need a volunteer real quick. Who's going to be that person? How about a young man right here in the end? Come on up here. It's not going to be as hard as you think, maybe. So this is the Bible of the Unreached. If you could find 1 Timothy 2, 4 for me. Find them, what does that say? Okay. Could you turn and show the group this Bible? It's a blank page. It's a blank book. So you can go back. Thank you for being willing to come up here. And what does 1 Timothy 2, 4 say? Talking about God desires all men to be saved and to come to the knowledge of the truth. For there is one God and one mediator between God and man, the man Christ Jesus, verse 5, verse 6, who gave himself a ransom for all to be testified in due time. You know, our neighbors and globally, people sit in darkness and in much fear. And then there are those, as we've been talking about, who have no idea. We'll be getting into the Amazon rainforest. We'll be going to Iraq. We'll be going to Africa, Indonesia, all over the place, looking at people groups who sit in darkness and they don't even have the chance to read that in their language. Those beautiful, beautiful verses. All right, back to Iraq. So I was able to go to Iraq here about 2 years. We're heading close to 2 years now. And at the request of an organization that's working in northern Iraq, in the Kurdistan area. In 2014, there was a horrendous thing that happened there in that country, and that is ISIS, Islamic radical Islamic group that swept across the country and in its wake left many devastated families and people, Christians, so ISIS is Sunni Muslim, and so there's a lot of Shia Muslim in that area, Muslims that flow over into Iran. Iran is Shia. And so they swept across, devastating people's lives, killing people. And one group in particular really took the brunt of their hate, and that was the Yazidi people group. You probably heard that name. You probably heard the word, if you can remember back that far, the word Sinjar, the mountain of Sinjar. The Yazidis fled kind of out of their home area and up onto the mountain of Sinjar. And there they were trapped. And the U.S. forces and allied forces actually kind of came in, I think, with helicopters and tried to evacuate them out of there. But the Yazidis are an ancient, they're a people group with an ancient religion. It's neither Christian nor Muslim. Supposedly going the whole way back to King Cyrus, they say. The quote, Christians in Iraq and the Muslims despise them, look down them. They're people have been exploited for years. And because of that, the Yazidis have been very closed people. No one could reach them. I mean, in 2014, there was no Christians among them. But here comes ISIS. Pushes them out of their homeland, takes her women as slaves, the young men, children as soldiers, and just devastated them. In 2015, some young men, Anabaptist young men, said, let's go help these people. And so they went into Iraq, into Kurdistan, right on the front lines pretty much. They could see the front lines with ISIS. They got in some really, really scary situations. If you want to hear some stories, get Kingdom Channels in to talk about that, some of the things they experienced there. And so Kingdom Channels is still there in that country today. I just want to make sure that this is not being recorded. If you could just make sure, Dustin, you got that. Thank you. So they is still working there, and 2.5 years ago, they reached out to us saying, hey, we really think this language, Shingali, needs a Bible translation. And we've actually started, but we discovered how big of a project this is. Could you help us? And so we said, okay, how can we help you? So we entered into dialogue with them, and as we expected, they soon began to realize that if you don't take some time and get some intentional training to be a Bible translator, it's really difficult and it's not ideal. When you translate God's word, you want to make sure that you're translating it well, and there's things that you need to learn, time that needs to be invested to become a translator that's going to do a good job, and they were not equipped for it. And so they said, hey, would you all consider coming and doing this? So that's when I went over, along with another representative within All Nations, actually a board member who was trained to be a Bible translator, who never made it to the field but became a board member and was called at some other things here in the States, went along over, and we visited them. So we're going to stop that, the information about this work. We're going to talk about a little hike that I went on that kind of ties into what our brother shared here this evening. And that is one morning, Saturday morning, I headed out with this gentleman right here. He's 70 years old, and he's been serving there. He's a widower man, and he's been serving there with these people, with Kingdom Channels. And been serving them, the Yazidi people, teaching them English, and quite a delightful gentleman, and loves the Lord with all his heart. And he goes hiking every Saturday morning. He hikes way back in the mountains. He's quite fit. And as I was discussing this little hike with one of the field members there, I told him I'm going with him tomorrow morning, this gentleman, on this big long hike, and he goes, whew. He goes, you're kind of getting back into some parts of the world where there's militias and stuff like that. He said, we always kind of hope he comes back. But we figure he's old enough, he's got a big white beard, that if some roving militia of some sort, Iranian militia actually, would come across him, they would respect him because he's an old man. Anyhow, so just keep that in the back of your mind as I tell the story. So we headed out, up across the mountain, and I discovered this 70-year-old man was way more fit than myself. Quite a climb. But here, we get to the top, and the top of the first ridge, the foothill, and we can look back across the city, the town that we're in. And this particular village right here is actually a Christian village. This little village kind of exists in a Muslim-dominated area. It's been there for years. And pretty much the Muslims just kind of let that village go. The government leaders just ignore it pretty much. And this little village has existed for probably hundreds of years there. And interestingly, 2.5 hours north, when ISIS swept through, the Yazidis got pushed out of their land and they flowed down into more southern Kurdistan or down into Iraq. And some came right into this village. And if you notice here on the left, there's a bunch of, so these are all lit up houses, but over here there's a bunch of houses that aren't lit up. And before 2014, Kurdistan was booming economically. And there was lots of money. And the government leader said, hey, take your money and we will give you tax discounts if you invest your money into property. So instead of blowing your money, go invest it in a house and you'll get some tax breaks. And so as people accumulated funds, they would buy a little piece of property in the town and start building a house. And so this little Christian village had a bunch of partially built houses. And you know who's in them today? It's Yazidi people living there. And in this little town now is a lot of Anabaptist people working with these people and also out into the broader area, into refugee camps and things like that. Quite a neat story. But if you look way over here, is the Tigris River. And then way down, I think I got the right river name. And then way over here in the distance is actually the city of Mosul, which is not safe to go into, and it's American, which is used to be Nineveh, the city, the biblical city of Nineveh. And so you're coming into a part of the world where you're like, okay, this place has been around for, humans have been here for a long time. You see architecture that goes back 1,000 years, and you'll soon see a little relief that I saw. So let's keep moving with our story. So I'm hiking with this man. We get up to the top. We see this really neat little picture. We keep on going, and we get way back in. And then he, on the top of the mountain, he says, "You see that ridge over there across the valley, that side over there?" So that's where we're heading. There's a neat spring that bubbles out of the mountain. We're going to fill our water bottles up and come back. And I'm standing there looking at that ledge, and I said, "Hey, brother," I said, "there's a bunch of little figures moving around there." He goes, I can't see it. I said, "No, I can see it. Hey, don't worry about it. It's probably just some shepherds." But I'm looking, it's like, it's not any sheep, it's humans. Remember that little story I told you about the day before conversation? So, okay, well, here we go. And we headed down the mountain and back up to this little footpath that wound around the mountain, and I'm behind him, and I know we're getting really close, and I'm now really keyed in. Like, when I pop around this mountain, what will we see? What will we encounter? And we came around the mountain, and there sat a whole circle of men, maybe 6 to 8 men, sitting in a circle. They're eating a meal that they have spread out on the ground. And to the right is a gun or two propped against this old stone wall. And there's a little fire built with a tea kettle on. And I took all that in just a quick glance. And now I look at the men. What are they going to do? How are they going to respond to me, this white American? And it wasn't but a couple seconds, and one of the men jumped up and turned and faced us and started walking towards us, and he put a smile on his face. And he could speak English. He said, "Welcome, welcome." He could speak broken English, the only one in the group that could. And the other men jumped up, and they were like, "Sit down, sit down." And so he sat down there on this ledge on the side of the mountain. We could look out across the plains of northern Iran. We sat down there on the ground, and they began to feed us goat cheese naan, which is a bread. They put on more water for chai. They put more walnuts of some sort on for roasting on the fire. We just had this epic picnic there on the side of this mountain. The neatest experience I've ever had, and I'll never forget it. And I've thought about that time a lot. I was a stranger in a very strange and what felt like a dangerous environment. And these men showed me kindness. They showed me hospitality. And I just want to quickly talk about two Greek words. I'm not a Greek scholar by any means, but there's two Greek words I want to talk about real quickly, just kind of help you understand maybe what I could have experienced and what I did experience. So hospitality, the Greek word for hospitality is philia xenos. Okay, so philia, what does that mean? Greek has several words for love, and what does philia mean?
Love,
brotherly love. Yeah, good. It's like, it's not just, you know, like friends love, it's like brotherly love, like love your enemy. Think Philadelphia is a city of brotherly love, right? Philia, okay? So, and then xenos is a stranger. So, brotherly love of strangers is the Greek word for hospitality. The opposite of that is a word that we'll probably recognize. It's been kind of thrown around in our world, and that is xenophobia. So, xeno, stranger, phobia. What's a phobia? At our house, When I see a mouse, I'm climbing up on the closest table to get out of there. Or when Trajan's gerbil gets out, I'm out of there. I have a phobia of mice. My wife and my boys kill the mice, and while the dad's on the top of the table, I have a phobia of mice. Okay, so fear of strangers, and that is what I was afraid I was going to experience that day, was xenophobia, fear of strangers. But I just want to challenge us that let's not be that. Let's be this, philia xenoth, love of strangers. And that can be done even with not even being able to speak to somebody. Like, most of those men were able to talk to me, but to us, but they had to sit down. They were nice and kind. It was the neatest experience that I've ever had. So, and it hit me, I'm almost never in the minority. I'm typically in the United States, I'm the majority. I just don't think about what it's like to be a stranger. A true stranger, and I experienced it that day and experienced a really good example of hospitality. So let's do that. We can exercise that right here in our towns, being kind to those around them, inviting those people in, and showing them radical kindness. So just some real quick pictures from there on that little hike. Just amazing part of the world. Here's an ancient, this actually was an ancient village right here. That Saddam Hussein destroyed. It was a village of dissenters up in the mountains, and he came in with his planes and destroyed that ancient village. It's an olive tree sticking up down there. But you can tell there was just centuries of work put into the terraces and the walls. That spring bubbling out of the mountain was just incredible to see. It's been there for, who knows, it could be 2,000 years. It's been there. And also, just another little interesting tidbit here. This is a relief there, not in the same area, but, I mean, where I was hiking, about 30 miles away, we went to see. And Sennacherib had these reliefs carved in the mountains around northern Iraq. He came in and conquered the then known world. This is actually him here in the back. These are all idols, like some kind of like calf or cow-like creature with a god, or I should say a god, standing on the back of the calf. They're all facing this way. And here in the back is Sennacherib. And you'll notice that his hand there is kind of like this, which means a sign of humility. His head's kind of bowed. And if you all remember, the historians here, Sennacherib comes up in the Old Testament, I think it's in Leviticus 34, I believe, where he comes to Jerusalem to conquer Jerusalem, and King Hezekiah, he have an incredible exchange, and Hezekiah cries out to God, and what happens that night? God destroys 130,000 of Sennacherib's troops, and Sennacherib flees, and God is victorious. But here we are, we're looking at a relief that he had carved in the mountain, that man, maybe 2,800 years ago. So Iraq, we're going to jump to our next project. So that's what we're looking at this evening, is just all projects. So while we're on Iraq here, just actually... this week, there's two couples coming back from Iraq that spent the summer there. Couples that have been trained with All Nations to actually do a language analysis, we call it. So basically, scientifically, in ways, sitting down with these people and taking their language and pulling it into a format where you can analyze it and compare it to other dialects in the area and determine how different is this dialect. So it's a fairly intricate process, and they were able to get there and do that this summer, which we're very thankful for. And just last week, we had a two-hour call with them on Zoom and a bunch of other Wycliffe people who have worked in that area, who understand all the different dialects and the dynamics going on there. and they shared all the things they've learned. And the conclusion is that these people do, in fact, need an adaptation. Like, their dialect is different enough from the other dialects that it does necessitate a Bible translation. So that's really exciting. The ones who worked there for years have been saying that they do need it, but we didn't want to just go by hearsay or we hope, but actually, do they in fact need it? And we didn't want to invest time into something that maybe a language that might die off. So Lord willing, over the next year, there'll be a team sent there to begin that process of seeing the Bible get translated into these people that, you know, at one time were absolutely closed, but now there's actually several Christians there among them. What Satan has meant it for evil, God has meant it for good. You know, there's a lot of just, they're still 7 years later, still grappling. They would have just passed the 7 year anniversary of when ISIS swept in. There's still incredible hurts. There's still women coming back from ISIS yet, even though ISIS is underground, but have been their slaves ever since. There's mothers missing children. It's just very sad. People still living in camps, but God is raising up followers of Jesus there. And also there's followers of Jesus that are there, they're just serving them in beautiful ways. So that's really exciting. Okay, so let's, our goal here is to be done by, I think, 8:40. So I got up here about an hour, so we're gonna keep cruising along here. I'll open up for some questions. Maybe as I do each project, I'll just open up for a short little bit. Any questions on this work in Iraq from anyone? Okay, all right. So the next part of the world we're going to is Colombia. So Colombia is in South America, and right here is where we're working at. We're working in two different places in the country of Colombia. Colombia is a diverse country with many different language groups. Some of you probably have read stories of Bible translators that have worked in Colombia and in the Amazon area. There's work been going on there for years with Wycliffe and New Tribes missions. So we're here. Our main base is right here in the southern part, way bottom part of Colombia, right here on the Amazon. And it's the city of Leticia. Leticia is about 40,000 people. And we have a couple there who's actually been living in Colombia for 6 years. They spent a couple years up here in more northwestern Colombia, actually doing a Spanish church plant and learning the culture of Colombia, learning Spanish really well, but with their goal of, at some point, moving down closer to the jungles, to the Amazon, to help then facilitate people, teams moving into the Amazon basin area. And so they are now there. They're currently there by themselves. We're praying that God raise up a family to join them there. You'll see the picture here right shortly. But they're there in Leticia. We send some of our members there just to spend several months with them to help them see the needs in that part of the world, to experience Colombian culture or the Spanish culture, and to work alongside of Daryl, who he was somebody anyone would want to be mentored by. So this is a picture of some of the different nations, if you will, different people groups in that part of the world. They say that in the whole Amazon basin area, there's probably 150 people groups that are unreached as of this point. And some of those, a small percentage of those, are even uncontacted tribes. So this is a huge area. You just can't imagine the size of that area and how difficult it is to get around. You'll see some pictures here shortly of that. So this is Daryl and Rose, sent by the Wills Ridge Mennonite Church. And they're serving there in Leticia. He's very involved with networking with other ministries, other indigenous folks. And his big vision is to see local indigenous folks raised up that can actually be sent to reach some of these unreached tribes, because it's almost impossible for an American to do it. We get way too much attention. I was just reading a report this afternoon of these two brothers right here. You'll see some pictures shortly of them and their travels over into what we call the lion's mouth of Colombia. So let's go back one more. I think we'll see it a little better here. So Colombia, and then this is Brazil. And do you see the dog's head or the lion's head? So ears, eyes, nose, bottom jaw. And they're moving, they're reaching a group called the Hupta, right here in the dog's mouth. And so they were just over there, and they're just realizing how much attention they get as they travel. And they're even changing some of their plans, because the more they travel into these areas, the more attention they get. And so you really want to make sure that it's very necessary to go to this area before you do, because there's just certain kind of liabilities that go with that. So Matthew Morehart, he served in Haiti for years. He and his wife did. They got married, moved down in Haiti, lived there in Haiti for years, working with Christian Aid Ministries, some other ministries there. And he was actually pastoring a couple of churches there. And he felt like the Haitians just forget how blessed they actually are. And so he did a presentation to them about all these unreached groups around the world, and some of those are Bibleists, for the Haitians, so they can kind of get a picture of the rest of the world. And in that process, he himself came down with a burden to become a Bible translator. And so he was in the process of working himself out of the leadership there and getting local Haitians in. And so he contacted all nations and went through the process of becoming an Old Testament translator. Quite a gifted brother. He's part Mexican, actually. A really beautiful family. And then this is Weston Durstein. Weston is from Oregon and is part of their team. And like I said, they're focused on going into the dog's mouth of Colombia to reach the Hupta people group. And we're hoping to see many more teams in the next 10 years of going out into different areas of the Amazon area. This is a picture of the Hupta, a people group that has no Bible, no church, that is scattered on the eastern side of Colombia and on over into Brazil. Brazil is a very difficult area to get into. They tend to watch. The government is way more involved there with the Amazon area, and they tend to, people get quickly reported back to the government if there's missionaries or foreigners there. And so they're really hoping to see a church get, a Bible-translated church get planted among the Hupta on the Colombia side, that it can actually then move over into the Brazil side. So how do you get around in the Amazon? You fly. There just isn't any roads. You just have thousands and thousands of miles of green carpet, like this right here. This is a picture that just took last week, I believe, as they flew over into that area. And I thought that's really neat to see that, like a mountain or something out there in the middle of that area. I thought that was a really neat picture. Just dropped it in here this afternoon as I was looking at the pictures they sent. Lots of flying, landing on little runways out in the bush, lots of boating. This is on the Amazon right here. This would be a tributary of the Amazon. This just happened the last week on their trip. They took out to visit a village to determine whether they're trying to find a place that would actually work for them to kind of live and to learn the language and culture. And so that was part of this trip. You boat, you fly, and you hike. That's the ways you get around in that part of the world. And fuel for boats is really expensive. It's quite an adventure. Traveling, how are you going to get? How will you get across that big puddle of water? This is one of their villages. Some really neat cooking apparatus of some sort there. A lady, a Hupta lady, baking. Community life there. Weston is trying to be brave and eat some soup that probably you pray over it and hope that it won't make you too sick, because it's quite a different diet in that part of the world. And you sleep at night in hammocks, which my boys would love that. But you see that, what kind of funny apparatus is that, Carson, on there? Mosquito net. Yeah, you always have a mosquito net with you to keep around you because, the mosquitoes are bad. And here's a picture of some of those folks as well. So you can pray. This is a very, very new project here that is happening. You can pray that God would open up doors, that they could find a really good place to settle in, that there would be an open door there. One of the problems, too, is people want you to bring them, if you're going to live with us, then you need to bring us all kinds of supplies. So it's like, we'll give you the privilege to live here if you just, you know, become like this big daddy that brings all the candy every time you come back from another part of the Columbia. And so that's quite a challenge. We're trying to figure out how to work with all of that. So any questions on Columbia? If you want an adventure and you're interested in just seeing what it's like to go to be in Columbia, Leticia, which is way down in the south, is kind of a tourist city right on the Amazon. So they see a lot of people flowing through there. It's about 40,000 people. So that's a part of Columbia that you can come and go, and it doesn't matter. So Daryl's end up hosting people that want to get down there and see what it's like in that part of the world. So if you ever have an interest, let us know. But yeah, any questions on Columbia? Okay, so let's go from Columbia over to Africa. How many people here have been on the continent of Africa? Raise your hand. One, two, three. Okay, good. I think you were telling me about, you were in Kenya, right? Yeah. Excuse me. So I've been in Africa once to visit the work that we have there. And Lord willing, going back this fall. And one of the things that stood out to me was their transport. I was mentioning this morning is how a lot of them, their mechanics have no training. And it's amazing what you see going down the road. In Africa, imagine East Africa is probably like as the same as West Africa. But I come from a transportation background. My dad's a truck driver. I grew up doing some driving. And the rigs you see coming down the road are just astounding. You just can't quite understand how they're even moving down the road. And then if something breaks, you do an engine overhaul around the road and there's traffic flying around you. It is quite an adventure. But yeah, we're here in the country of Niger, which is right on what we call the Sahel of Africa. It's where the sands of the Sahara and the grasslands of the savannah meet. Sahel is an Arabic word which means coast, so it's kind of like a coast that runs all the way across Africa. And in this area are many, many unreached people groups, Muslim groups in particular. The Muslims have really traveled across here, basically by just over the last couple hundred years, using trades. They worked their way across Africa, and in their wake, they have left many people converted to Islam. They left mosques. My wife and I, on our trip we were in the country of Benin, from Benin down to the coast. I think on the bus that we took the route, I want to say it was over 100 mosques that we counted on that trip, a 6-hour trip. So just moss just dot the landscape. And just this afternoon, this brother right here, he and his wife who live there, was telling me how, sent me a message, was saying how radical Islam just continues to rear its head. They have a conference that's happening with their people group there in northern Niger, and there's no way that he as an American can go up there. Because it's too dangerous. He said he would have to have a serious armed guard, like convoy. And of course, they're not interested in that, so he doesn't go. Just the locals, the Africans go up there. But yeah, we're there working with the Fulani people group. The Fulani are a large nomadic people group. And Caleb and Rolanda are quite gifted linguists, very gifted. They have a third child now, and they have weathered the hot weather of Africa, of that area, quite well. They spent time out in the country, even in a Fulani village, which, like I said, the Fulani are semi-nomadic. They tend to herd cows and camels. And so they're kind of on the move. They can be kind of a difficult people to actually get to know because they tend to move and they'll be gone from their villages for a while and then maybe come back. They do a little bit of farming, as you see right here. But so they actually lived with them. They got out there and planted with them. They did, helped winnow their millet with them. They ate with them. They spent time in the village in getting to know them as a people and learning their language. And I think in a year and a half, they learned their language quite well, which is pretty astounding. But like I said, Caleb and Rolanda are gifted linguists. And so that now Caleb is actually working with a mother tongue team doing the Old Testament translation. So we're there actually working under another organization that needed somebody to come and help guide the work. And Caleb was quite interested in that. And so he went, sent by us, but seconded or partnering with SIM, which is an older mission agency working in Africa for years. So we're there. So we moved into a project that was already going. The New Testament is done. Caleb, he's a Hebrew scholar, Old Testament translator. So he's helping with the Old Testament, which you'll see the mother tongue team here right shortly. Just a quick little interesting story here. Two little cultural tidbits on babies there in that culture in the Fulani. So in the morning, Caleb and Rolanda said they wake up at 5 o'clock range, 5, 6 o'clock, and they can already hear the ladies out pounding their pestle and mortars, grinding up their grain for the day. And they said, if you notice a different rhythm, you know there was a baby born in the village. And then if you listen some more, you can tell by the rhythm whether it's a little boy or a little girl. So it's kind of a neat little cultural thing. And then when you go to visit the baby, unlike us here in the West that want to give compliments to a little baby, they don't give compliments. They'll say things like, wow, she looks like a donkey, or whatever bad description you can think of. And it's quite shocking at first, but the reason they do that is because they're fearful of the evil spirits. And if they would give the baby a compliment, it would attract the evil spirits. And so they call their little babies all kinds of ugly things, even your best friend's baby. So that's just another little interesting tidbit, culture that you learn when you're there. So Caleb and Rolanda are now living in the city of Maradi. They're working in a translation office. They're building this house, this little, basically a tiny house there with a good friend of theirs who is a Fulani man. He's actually on the Bible translation team. As you can see there, they wanted to live right with kind of several Fulani folks. They're the people that are actually there in the city. And so one of the men said, yes, you can build a little house here. And so Caleb's are in the process of doing that. Here is Caleb on the left in a translation office with these men who've been working on their language, getting the Bible translated into language for a number of years. Just another picture. The man here on the left, I want to tell you a little bit of a story about him. His name is Tumbaya. Right here, again, is Tumbaya right here, out in one of those northern parts of Niger at a conference speaking. And Tumbaya is my age, or right in that range. Oftentimes people from other cultures like this hardly know what their age is, but he's in my age range, 38 in that range. And Tumbaya is quite a gifted, very gifted man. Caleb says that as he travels across Niger, interacting with different family clans within his people group and their language group, every area kind of has a different culture or maybe a different way of interacting. And he said, it's amazing. He said, Tobiah is one of those men that just, he knows how to contextualize himself in the different contexts. And he said, people really appreciate Tobiah. But there's a story behind that. When Tobiah was a young child, maybe Carson's age, 8, 9 years old, his dad became a Christian. And his dad became a Christian through some missionaries who were there that were actually out in the bush traveling with the Fulani. So 30 years ago, the Fulani were very much more nomadic, not as village-based. And that was because there wasn't the population there. Also, desertification is happening, where the desert is moving down into their areas and making it difficult to graze their cattle. And so some of them have to like give it up and, you know, farm or work in the city. So this missionary couple traveled with the Fulani, putting themselves in danger, but through their work, Tobiah's dad became a Christian. And unlike Fulani, who are not interested in education, Tobiah's dad was. And he sent Tobiah down to the city to a Christian school to get educated. He wanted Tobiah to have a chance to learn how to read and write and all those things. And so Tobiah did that. And while he was in school there in this kind of Christian environment in that part of the city, he went and moved into high school. The Bible translation was just getting started, or the team was just getting started to do the New Testament in his language, and these people noticed that Tobiah was quite gifted linguistically, and so they pulled him into their translation team and said, we want you to come part, they asked him to join, we want you to be part of this. And so he did, just a teenager, upper teenager, he joined this translation team for his own language. And he's been part of that ever since. But he gets out of high school, and at some point within a year or two of that, he told the translation team, "Hey, I want to go to Bible school. I want to learn more about the Bible." And right away, the team was very sad about that. And here's why: in that part of the world, whenever someone goes to Bible school, they have to go to a Hausa Bible school. And Hausa is kind of the dominant people group in the area. And the Fulani even say that if you become a Christian, you became Hausa. So they're kind of a Christianized group in ways. And the Hausa look down the Fulani. There's animosity there. And they don't like each other. And whenever a Fulani wants to go to Bible school, he goes to a Hausa Bible school. He kind of becomes Hausa and no longer wants to work with his own people. He feels quite above them, condescending towards them. And so they were really sad because they said, if Tobiah goes to a house of Bible school, he's gone and we need him. He's just so gifted in so many areas and has so much potential. Anyhow, so they began to pray about it, these missionaries did, and they reached out to the missionary network saying, does anybody know of a Fulani Bible school? And sure enough, over in the country of Cameroon, which is to the west of Niger, there was a Fulani Bible school. And so even though it was a different dialect, they still sent Tobiah and said, hey, you go over there for 2 years, join that Bible school. And he did. And him being linguistically gifted with languages, he quickly adapted to that language, a little different language, and did well. Got his 2 years, and he came back and joined back up with the translation team and has been part ever since. And so, and he's a man who has incredible vision for his people. Like I said, he travels a lot. They now have the New Testament in their language that he's helping to get out to his people, discipling people. Like you see right here, I just love that picture. Boy, could you imagine sitting in a church service dressed up like that? It's fascinating. different places that the Christian church is. And so, Tobiah is in some ways an apostle Paul to his own part of the world there, traveling and adapting himself so that some can be saved. Praise the Lord. Any questions on the Madra, which is actually a code name for the Fulani? So if you go to our website, we have, for security purposes, we don't name the people groups for a lot of our work. And so the Madra is the name for this work. But any questions on this work? Okay, that is fine. Okay, let's move along. We need to keep moving along here. Time is getting away, as always. Okay, so let's go back around the world to Central America, to the Mayunga people of Nicaragua. The Mayunga people are over here on the west side of Nicaragua. They are an indigenous people group, so they have their own lands that they've lived on for hundreds of years. And they were evangelized, the Mayunga people, by the Moravians, like back in the 18th century, 1800s. But sadly, the Moravians did not translate the Bible into their language. They said, hey, the Miskito people, which are right next door, kind of a predominant people group, they have the Bible in their language. Just read their Bible. And so what do you think happened? These people were reading the Bible in another language that they hardly knew. Do you think they could understand it? No, it was very difficult for them to understand. And so what happened? Quickly, they became a people that were very syncretistic, if you will. Syncretism is this kind of a veneer, like just very thin Christians. Maybe they looked like it, acted like it. We'll see a picture here shortly. You can kind of see they actually, when they come to church, the women actually need to walk in the back door. They put a little veiling on, as the Moravians have taught them. But they have no idea what that means. On a Sunday morning, the elder who brings a message will, on Monday morning, be the shaman or the witch doctor. That's their state of Christianity in this people group. And Ben, at 21 years old, a single man, was working with some of the Bichi missions in the western part of Nicaragua, felt a call to these people. And he moved in with them, and as someone has said, became the incarnation of Christ to these people. Gifted young man. Then and now, he's not so young now, my age. So not in his 20s, his upper 30s, but or 40, but incredibly gifted. And he learned their language. And people say he actually knows their language better than themselves. And he started working in translation of just different literature, the Intorcha, or the Torch of Truth, by some of the Bichi churches that put out down there. Began to get that translated, and through that, began to notice that their Bible, which actually had gotten translated by three or two ungodly men in the last like 20 or 30 years. Two men took it and did a quick translation kind of out of the Spanish and Mixtec and did a terrible job of it, sadly. And he began to notice that their Bible had incredible need for revision and changes because it was not done right at all. And so out of that, he began to develop a burden for seeing the Bible get translated into Mayunga. And so back maybe 6 years ago, he joined All Nations. He's been in training since, working with his people there. And actually, while living there among them, he married one of their girls. Anissa here is a Mayunga lady. And there's several true Christian families among them that Ben has been working with and helping to disciple. And ended up marrying one of their daughters. They have two children there, as you can see, little Ben and Jean. Here is the rest of his family, or I'm sorry, her family. They actually, all of them are following Christ, striving to follow Christ the whole way, dedicated Christians. And most of them are actually part of working at helping get the Bible translated into their language. This picture is actually taken in Honduras. The Mayunga territories have come under attack by the surrounding Spanish. their lands have a lot of resources. They have gold and lots of resources there. Agriculturally, it's an incredible place to grow crops. And so because of that, the Spanish people have been pushing in and actually killing them and pushing them out with force. And so they had to flee out of Honduras, out of Nicaragua, and currently are at a Mennonite mission base living right now there in Honduras, just to get away from the refugees, to get away from the fighting that's there. And so we can pray that God would bring peace to that area so they can move back and continue to disciple and teach. Here's a picture of a Sunday morning service there in the Moravian church. Women come in, put the little cap on. But like I said, it's very syncretistic. It's a mix of animistic tribal beliefs. Picture the village, cacao, coffee. Ben has helped them raise crops, learn new crops. He's just poured himself into these people. Here's some of the people that are moving in to take over their lands right here. It's a really, really sad picture, a sad reality of what's happening. And we continue to get updates almost every day of different things that are going there on in that part of the world. And of course, Nicaragua itself is in upheaval as well. At the translation table. And then this is a rock that we have in our prayer garden there, All Nations. Not all of our projects have it done yet, but our goal is to see a rock with the project name and a Bible verse there in our prayer garden at our base, where people can walk through and remember to pray for these people. So this rock actually just got done in the last 2 months. And this verse right here is out of Psalms 117. And it's actually, it's a verse that's back translated from Mayanga back into English. So it's kind of following the same form, which is maybe it's a little bit different than what an English translation would actually do because of it being back translated. So any questions on the Mayanga? We have about 7 projects to go through, and I think we're getting hopefully over halfway. All right, let's keep rolling along here. The Mixtec of Southern Mexico. This is our longest project that we have had going. Back in 2015, Ethan and Lene came through. They had already been in training for 4 or 5 years. They were our first people on our base in State College to come and take some of the last training before they hit the field. They are soldiers, if ever there was anybody. Incredible endurance. They've labored there among these people by themselves for a number of years, have won their trust, have learned their language, and are doing Bible translation as we speak. She is quite gifted as well. They both are Greek scholars, and she helps out every day with the translation of the New Testament. And then in the last 2 years, 2 more couples have joined them, which is really exciting. Jordan's from Ethan's church, which is a German Baptist church out of Washington, and then Leonard and his wife out of Pennsylvania here from Shippensburg Christian Fellowship. And he is a New Testament translator, and he is a community development person. Some pictures of the Mixtec project there, a picture of their town, Mixtec children. They recently got phone service into their area. A phone in a tree is their phone service. I got a good kick out of that. And right here, Ethan actually just sent me this picture this morning. He said they were, this is one of the main roads going into the village. I'm not going to get very far. So I got washed out. And here is Ethan working with a mother tongue speaker. His name is Alejandra. Like I said, the Mixtec people were very suspicious of outsiders. They've been exploited so many times. So it's taken them years to gain the trust of these people. And there isn't many who are interested. But Alejandra is one of those that is. And they said it's amazing to see him reading the Bible in his language, which he would have been somewhat familiar with in Spanish. He would know a little bit of Spanish, but being able to actually read the Bible in his language has brought change into his life already. Just some literacy brochures they made to help stimulate interest in him actually getting the Bible or getting literature into Mixtec. And this is the rock in the prayer garden. The people that walked in darkness, Mixtec of Mexico, have seen a great light. Isaiah 9:2. All right. We're just going to move into the last three here, two, and then I'll open up for questions after that. So that was in Central America again, in Mexico. And now we're going the whole way around the world to the country of Indonesia, the largest Muslim country in the world, 350,000 people in this country, scattered across, I think, 10,000 different islands. So Indonesia is a land of islands, and over here on the western, on the eastern side of this big island called Borneo, is several folks striving to reach a large Muslim group called the Kutai, about 400,000 or 500,000 strong, a very proud people. That's Levi and his wife and family from Kansas, Arlington Mennonite Church. He's a community development facilitator. He's starting salt savings groups there and other things. Matthew and Andrea Nisley from another church right next door. The two churches are working together on this project. And also Heidi King, a single lady who's actually just joining their work this year to help them there. So this is a picture of the Kutai people. The man sitting there is actually like a village elder. And here, Levi, this is back when they went over in 2016 to meet these people and to find out if, do these people in fact need a Bible translation? Here, this village elder is reading out of Psalms. He's reading it in Indonesian. So Indonesian is the trade language of Indonesia. And he's an educated person, well-to-do, Kutai man, and he's has Levi's laptop, iPad, and he's reading a psalm. He has no idea he's reading the Bible. And he's looking at it, he's trying to read it in Indonesian. And he stumbles along, and he turns to Levi and goes, if this was in my language, I could understand this. Just a little antidote of some of the work we do in surveying people or language groups as we try to determine whether they do they actually need a Bible. Here's Levi. Levi is quite a, he's somebody who exercises the gift, his gift, God-given gift of hospitality, of philia, zenoth, and many people have become his friends. He's a man who loves beekeeping. He gets in all kinds of situations helping others in the beekeeping world there in Indonesia and in teaching others. He loves cattle. He's raising some cattle, but also starting, like I said, savings groups. And God's really using him as a bridge in these people's lives. Here's a young man. His name is, we'll just call him Hans here. I think I'll probably just move ahead here pretty quickly. But going back to Hans, Hans is an Indonesian man, young boy, 17 years old, I think, that just recently chose to follow Christ there. And as Levi says, in America, when you decide to follow Christ as a young man, that's a celebration. People are excited. But in Indonesia, where he's from, his religion is not excited about that. His parents are very upset. And this man, this young boy, has taken incredible hits already because of his choice to follow Christ. So you can pray for him. We can call him Hans. And that God would just continue to lead him and would raise him up to be effective in his kingdom there. So this is the rock in the prayer garden back in State College, the Kutai of Indonesia. To you the nations will come from the ends of the earth. To him they will know that my name is Yahweh. And it's out of Jeremiah. Okay, we'll spin back around the world again. Back to the country of Mexico. Northern Mexico, the Copper Canyon area, is a people group called the Tarahumara. Up here in northern Mexico, in the Copper Canyon area. Maybe some of you might have seen the Copper Canyon already just as tourists, but in that huge canyon is where this group of people live, scattered across the canyon, and there's been a missionary family reaching them for the last 10 years, and they need a Bible in their language. And so Pauline Hoover and David Rosine and Juanita Byler are all there, just landed there in the last year, and are learning Tarahumara. They plan to teach them how to read and get the Bible translated into their language. Just some pictures of the Tarahumara people. Like I said, they're quite a They're people that live in the canyons, so lots of hiking. Takes a lot of endurance to live there. And the small group of believers that are there, striving to follow Jesus there. Here is one of the ladies on the team teaching literacy to this group of young children, teaching them how to read. Maybe someday this young boy here will be an elder in that fledgling congregation. And this is a team that is reaching them there. Any questions on the Kutai of Indonesia, on the Tarahumara of Mexico? Let's see, the one before that would have been the Mayanga of Nicaragua. Any questions on any of those before we just wrap this up? I would love to show you around the prayer garden sometime there in State College. You ever get a chance? Have you been in the prayer garden yet, Paul? Yeah. It's a little garden that we have there with those rocks, and you can come and kind of see and hear about the different things that are going on. We love taking visitors there, so you're welcome to come by anytime. So let's wrap this up. So what is your part? Do you have a part to play in this? And I think I've stressed that today. It's local churches that do these kind of things, that reach people like this. So there's many things you can do. You can follow our newsletter, our email, our blog, our YouTube channel, which has a lot of teaching and interesting things on it, by the way. You can pray for the work. You can give. And you can go. Many different ways to participate in this. We have a sponsor, a project that you can monthly give to a project, and with that, along with that comes some additional information about what's happening on the field. That I think we have it on our website for sure at allnations.com. I'm not sure if I have any prayer cards back there actually. I think I failed to bring those along this time. Sorry about that. We also have some CDs on the table back here talking about the history of the English Bible, and some DVDs on God's Word Enduring Through the Ages. Paul Shirk had a part to do in this, a pretty big part, in helping develop this video resource. We have it on our YouTube channel as well, but also some DVDs back here looking at how God has preserved His Word through the ages. It's a powerful video series to watch. Thank you so much for letting me be here. It's been a real blessing to be here today with you and talk about the work that God is doing that's way bigger than me, bigger than you, bigger than all nations, bigger than big things that He's doing, but with many people just doing their little part. So God bless you as you serve God here in this part of the world. I'll be back at the table afterwards. If you have any questions, feel free to stop by and ask me then. And I see that I'm over time, so I better sit down.
You certainly feel like a smaller spot in the world. We think of all those different people out there, and many people out there trying to reach them. All those who are able, let's kneel for prayer.